27. We found Lydia in the schoolroom, trying to restore a semblance of order to the papers, paint pots, plastic alphabets, and picture books that lay scattered over the tables or trampled into the floor by muddy feet. She came to the doorway. "Oh, God," she cried, "what am I to do?" She was a capable and intelligent woman in her early 40s, a divorcee with 2 young boys. Her hair was grey and cut in a fringe above a pair of steady brown eyes. She was so capable and plainly so used to rising above every crisis that she refused to admit to herself or others that her nerves were frayed to breaking. In the middle of the morning, she had gone to take a radio call from her mother, who was sick in Melbourne. When she came back, the kids had dipped their hands into a can of green paint and slapped it round the walls. "Well, at least they didn't shit on the desks," she said, "this time." Her boys, Nicky and David, were playing with their black friends in the schoolyard in their underpants, muddied from head to toe and swinging like monkeys from the aerial roots of a fig tree. Nicky, frantic with excitement, shouted obscenities at his mother and stuck out his tongue. "I'm going to drown you," she shouted back. She stretched her arms across the doorway, as though to prevent us from entering, but then said, "Come in, come in. I'm only being silly." She stood in the middle of the room, paralysed by the chaos. "Let's have a bonfire," she said. "The only thing to do's to have a bonfire and burn the lot. Burn and begin again." Arkady comforted her in the reverberative Russian voice he usually reserved for women to calm them. Lydia then led us towards a sheet of fibreboard on which was pinned up the work of the art class. "The boys paint horses and helicopters," she said. "But can I get them to do a house? Never. Only girls do houses and flowers."
"Interesting," said Arkady.
"Do look at these," she smiled. "These are funny." They were a pair of crayon drawings, one of an emu monster with atrocious claws and beak. The other was a hairy ape man with a jaw full of fangs and flashing yellow eyes like headlights.
"Where's Graham?" Arkady asked suddenly.
Graham was Lydia's assistant. He was the boy I had seen in Alice as I was leaving the motel. "Just don't speak to me about Graham," she shuddered. "I don't want to know about Graham. If anyone says the word Graham again, I may do something violent." She made another half-hearted effort to clear up one of the desks, but stopped and took a deep breath. "No," she said, "it's no use. I'd much rather face it in the morning." She locked up, called to the boys and made them put on their Space Invader T-shirts. They were barefoot. They trailed us reluctantly across the compound, but since there were so many thorns and bits of broken glass, we decided to carry them piggyback. We passed the Lutheran chapel, boarded up now for 3 years. We then passed the community centre, a blue metal hangar on which there was painted a cartoon procession of honey ants. From inside came the sound of country and western music. An evangelical meeting was in progress. I put David down and poked my head around the door. On stage stood a pale Aboriginal half-caste in tight, white bell-bottom pants and a shiny scarlet shirt. His hairy chest was festooned with gold chains. His pot belly seemed to have been added as an afterthought, and he was swivelling on his high heels, doing his best to rouse a rather grumpy congregation.
"Okay," he crooned. "Come on now, give it voice. Give voice to Jesus."
The verses, projected on slides, came up one by one onto a screen. "Jesus is the sweetest name I know, and he's the same as his name, and that's why I love him so."
"Now you see," said Arkady, "what some of us have to contend with."
"Bathos," I said. Lydia and the boys lived in a shabby prefabricated house of 3 rooms, which had been set down in the shade of an ironwood. She threw her briefcase onto an armchair.
"And now," she said, "I've got to face the kitchen sink."
"We've got to face it," said Arkady. "You've got to put your feet up."
He took some toys off the daybed and guided her feet firmly onto it. There were 3 days' dirty dishes in the kitchen, and the ants were everywhere. We scoured the grease from aluminium saucepans and boiled a kettle. I cut up some steak and onions for a stew. Over a second pot of tea, Lydia began to unwind and to talk quite rationally about Graham. Graham had come straight to Popenjee from a teacher training college in Canberra. He was 22. He was innocent, intolerant, and had a smile of irresistible charm. He could turn quite nasty if anyone called him angelic. He lived for music, and Pintupi boys were born musicians. One of his first acts on arrival was to start the Popenjee band. He scrounged the sound equipment from a moribund radio station in Alice. They practiced in the disused doctor's surgery, which still had its electric wiring intact. Graham took the drums for himself. There were two guitarists, sons of Albert Chuckamara. The keyboard player was a fat boy who styled himself Danny Roo. The singer and star was a whip-like 16-year-old, Long Fingers Mick. Mick had his hair in rasta plaits and was a mesmerizing mimic. After 5 minutes of watching a video, he could do Bob Marley or Hendrix or Zappa. But his best performance was to roll his syrupy eyes and spread his huge, pouty mouth into a grin and become his namesake, Jagger himself. Travelling and sleeping in Graham's old Volkswagen van, the band toured the settlements, from Yuendumu to Ernabella and even as far afield as Balgo. They sang a dirge about police killings called the Ballad of Barrow Creek. They had an upbeat number called Aborasta, another more morally uplifting, against petrol sniffing. They made a tape and then a 7-inch disc, and then they had a hit on their hands. Grandfather's Country became the song of the outstation movement. Its theme was eternal, go west, young man, go west. Away from cities and government camps, away from drink, glue, hash, smack, jail, out, back to the desert from which grandfather was hounded. The refrain, mobs of people, had a slightly liturgical tone, like bread of heaven, and drove the audiences wild. At the Alice Rock Festival, where they played it, ancient Aboriginal greybeards were seen skittering and bopping with the kids. A promoter from Sydney took Graham aside and seduced him with the blather of show business. Graham went back to his job at Popenjee, but was hardly there in spirit. He had visions of his music sweeping Australia and the rest of the world. He pictured himself starring in a road movie. He was soon lecturing Lydia about agents, agents' fees, recording rights and movie rights. She heard him out in silence, with misgivings. She was too honest not to admit it, jealous. She had mothered Graham, fed him, sewn the patches on his jeans, tidied his house, and listened to his idealistic hot talk. What she loved most in him was his seriousness. He was a doer. The opposite of her ex-husband, whose idea it had been to work for Aboriginals, and who'd then nipped off to Bondi. What she dreaded above all was the thought that Graham might leave. To be alone, without home or money, with two boys to bring up, nagged with worry that the government might cut back funds and she be made redundant. None of that mattered, as long as Graham was around. She was afraid, too, for Graham himself. He and his black friends would go bush for days on end. She never pressed him for details, yet she suspected, just as she'd suspected her husband of heroin, that Graham was mixed up in Aboriginal business. Eventually, he couldn't resist telling her. He described the dancing and singing, the bloodletting and sacred diagrams, and told her how he'd been painted all over in bands of white and ochre. She warned him that Aboriginals' friendship was never pure. They would always look on whites as a resource. Once he was one of them, he'd have to share everything. "They'll have the Volkswagen off you," she said. He turned on her with a smile of amused contempt and said, "Do you think I'd care?" Her second set of fears she kept to herself. She was afraid that once you joined, you joined. Whether it was a secret society or aspiring, your life from then on was marked. At her previous post in Gruta Island, a young anthropologist had been given ritual secrets, but when he published them in his thesis, he suffered from headaches and depressions, and could now live only outside Australia. Lydia willed herself not to believe the stories of bone-pointing and of sorcerers who could sing men to their doom. All the same, she had an idea that the Aboriginals, with their terrifying immobility, had somehow got Australia by the throat. There was an awesome power in these apparently passive people who would sit, watch, wait, and manipulate the white man's guilt. One day, after Graham had gone missing for a week, she asked him straight, "Do you or don't you want to teach?" He folded his arms.
"I want to, yes," he replied with inconceivable insolence, "but not in a school run by racists."
She gasped, wanted to block her ears, but he went on mercilessly. The educational program, he said, was systematically trying to destroy Aboriginal culture and to rope them into the market system. What Aboriginals needed was land, land and more land, where no unauthorized European would ever set foot. He ranted on. She felt her answer rising in her throat. She knew she shouldn't say the words, but the words came bursting out. "In South Africa they've a name for that. Apartheid." Graham walked from the house. The break from then on was total. In the evenings the bam, bam, bam of the band struck her as something evil and menacing. She could have reported him to the education authority. She could have had him fired. Instead, she shouldered all his work and taught both classes herself. Sometimes she came into the schoolroom and found "Lydia loves Graham" scrawled up on the blackboard. Early one morning, as she watched the sunlight spread over the bedsheets, she heard Graham's voice in the front room. He was laughing with Nicky and David. She closed her eyes, smiled, and dozed off again. Later, she heard him tinkering in the kitchen. He came in with a cup of tea, sat on the end of the bed, and gave her the news.
"We've made it," he said.
Grandfather's Country was number 3 in the national hit parade. The band was to be given star billing in Sydney, at The Place. All airfares and hotels paid.
"Oh," she said, and let her head fall back on the pillow.
"I'm glad. You deserve it. You do, you know, every bit of it." Graham had accepted to play the first concert in Sydney on February 15th, and in his haste to sign the contract, had put all other considerations aside. He forgot, or pretended to forget, that the rains came in February, and that February was the month for initiations. He forgot his friend Mick was due to be initiated into the Bandicoot clan, and he put out of his mind the fact that he, Graham, in a moment of bravura, had agreed to be initiated with him. Initiation ceremonies the world over are staged as a symbolic battle in which the young man, to prove his virility and fitness for marriage, must bare his sexual organs to the jaws of a bloodthirsty ogre. The knife of the circumciser is a substitute for the carnivore's fang. In Aboriginal Australia, the puberty rites will also include head-biting, at which the elders gnaw at the boys' skulls or jab at them with sharpened points. Sometimes the boys pull out their own fingernails and stick them back on with their blood. The ceremony takes place in secret, at a dreaming site far from the eyes of strangers. Afterwards, at a seminar made unforgettable by pain, the sacred couplets are dinned into the heads of the initiates, who, meanwhile, are made to crouch over fires of smouldering sandalwood. The smoke is said to have anaesthetic properties, which assist the wounds to heal. For a boy to delay his initiation is to risk being stranded in a lifeless, asexual limbo. To evade it altogether was, until recently, unheard of. The performance can drag on for weeks, if not months. Lydia was a little vague as to what happened. Graham, it seems, was frantic with worry they would miss the first concert. Mick made a terrible scene and accused Graham of abandoning him. Eventually everyone arrived at a compromise, whereby Graham would only suffer token cuts, and Mick would be allowed to shorten his period of isolation. He would return to Popengie in order to practice with the band, but would also have to spend several hours each day in session with the elders. He also promised not to leave until 2 days before the concert. At first everything went without a hitch, and on February 7th, as soon as Mick was fit to walk, he and Graham returned to the settlement. The weather was damp and sultry, and Mick insisted on rehearsing in a pair of skin-tight blue jeans. On the night of February 9th, he woke from a nightmare to find the wound had gone horribly septic. Graham then panicked. He bundled all the sound equipment and the players into the Volkswagen and, before dawn, drove off to Alice. Lydia got up that morning to find the house surrounded by a furious mob, some waving spears, accusing her of hiding the fugitives or helping them escape. 2 carloads of men gave chase, in order to fetch Mick back. I told Lydia I'd seen Graham, looking more or less demented, outside the motel. "What can one do?" she said. "Except see the funny side of it.